The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts. The temple is an affiliate of Boundless Way Zen, a multi-lineage school of Zen Buddhism.
Case 7 from the Blue Cliff Record. A monk said to Fayen, "My name is Hui Chao. I ask you, what is Buddha?" Fayan said, "You are Wei Chao." A monk said to Fayan, "My name is Wei Chao. I ask you, what is Buddha?" Fayan said, "You are Wei Chao." So here at Boundless Way Temple, on this bright and chilly morning, sun shining, reflecting off of the snow, the brick path in the garden has been cleared, so I wandered out in the garden before our sutra service. And so lovely with everything covered, trees bare, but still here in the middle of winter, the azaleas and the rhododendron still leaves, still green, and buds tightly held, waiting and waiting. And on our altar, we have a wondrous amaryllis plant. That has been sprouting and sprouting, green columns rising, buds on top swelling, and one bud now opening like the claw of a lobster, and a little red tongue now sticking up, the glorious amaryllis flower, now just a little bit of red. And this wondrous process of the amaryllis knowing how to be itself. And this bud knowing its own time. Knowing without knowing its own time. And for me, these growing things and these buds and leaves, things that die away and come back, these bulbs that are quite unattractive. The big amaryllis bulb, I put it in some soil maybe 2.5 weeks ago. It looked very unpromising, right? What is this clumpy turnip-like thing? But it sure enough sent up these green sprouts. And now is in the process of giving us endless hours of very slow entertainment. The plot, we sort of know where it's going, and yet for me, every time we walk by, I take a little peek. Oh, a little bigger, a little more red. And the wonder of how an amaryllis flower, which is quite... Quite overly extravagant, I think. You know, if you really think about it, it doesn't need to be that showy. Kind of delighting in its excess, but now hidden, now perfectly hidden, and not as a tiny flower. If we cut open the bud to get the flower, hoping, well, I'll get a little amaryllis flower. I'll take it out. No, we would not find that. And so we wait patiently as the amaryllis reveals itself in this mindless brilliance. simply being what it is. And so here too, in the Zendo, in the meditation hall, we, like the amaryllis, are mindlessly brilliant. Each one of us being exactly who we are. I love it when we do something or something happens and we say, well, that wasn't me. That wasn't me. Well, who was it? Some of you know recently we've been having, you know, from time to time we have mysterious occurrences at the temple, being a partly public place. And about 5 or 6 weeks ago, when my cold first started, which is getting better, thank you very much. When it first started, I got some cough medicine. Actually, Melissa got it for me, and two kinds, and one I was using. And one of the bottles of cough medicine disappeared from the sink. And I noticed it a couple days, you know, at some point. And we realized that it seemed to have happened after one of our Tuesday evening sittings, and we wondered who could it be, and had all of these concerns about, you know, felt sorry for someone having to steal a bottle of cough syrup. So I made sure, you know, not to keep the rest of it in public. But just yesterday, I uncovered the culprit. It turned out that this thief had taken the bottle of cough syrup and put it into my backpack in a pouch I don't use very often. So I'm sure he was quite well-meaning, wanted me to have it with me. But unfortunately, I forgot that that was me who did that. I am quite embarrassed by myself and relieved that that I am the thief. No outsider, no trouble, just me. And this just me is quite a thing. Just you. And it is so easy to discount. So easy to bypass. As we live our life, we are beyond ourselves in an instant, looking somewhere else. Buddha. What is Buddha? The student comes and ask the teacher, my name is Hui Chao. Just like our interviews, my name is, and then presenting himself, he presents himself to the teacher with his true question, what is Buddha? And of course the teacher could have answered in all kinds of different ways. And in these koan stories, teachers often answer in unexpected ways. And as we first enter koans, these unexpected ways can look rather rude, as if the teacher is trying to reprimand the student, or the teacher is doing something, pulling some kind of Zen trick. But as we have been sitting with koans these past 2.5 weeks, I hope we've been able to move a little beyond that into this possibility that these teachers and these Dharma brothers and sisters are actually doing the absolute best they can to communicate something directly. And this thing that we are trying to communicate is not a Buddhist thing. It is not a thing that can be quantified and measured. So we are trying to transmit, to share with each other, trying to share that which cannot be spoken of. In the Jewish tradition, there's one tradition that God's name should not be spoken. God is not God, but I am that I am. Because any name we use, anything we call it, is a mistake. Because the mind thinks a word is a thing, and there are actually not things in this world. The idea of permanence, of things, of nouns, is just a convenience, just a way of thinking about it, just like in your computer. And I don't mean to upset any of you, but there are no little folders. If you open up your computer hoping to get one of the little folders out, you will not find it, right? But yet that works well enough for us to be able to retrieve the file and look at it one more time. So it is in this world that appears to be a world of things. There's the car and the road and the grocery store. And so when we get in the car and drive down the road, the grocery store hopefully is where we remember it. Although I do wonder for our Tenzo going out, hoping she can remember where the grocery store is after practicing for so long. But so far she always comes back. We put a little anklet on her just in case she gets lost so we can go rescue her as all of us on this long retreat or even on a short retreat, we all get lost. I hope we all get lost because your conception of reality, your map of reality, that is so important and that got you here. This map is not true. And what you believe about yourself is not true. It may be helpful and useful and we can bring awareness to ourselves and have insights about ourselves and our patterns. But ultimately, what we're doing here is beyond that. We're not trying to be better than we were. We are in the business of liberation. We are in the business of living in some radically new way. And we get to practice this radical new way. This radical new way is the way of the amaryllis bud. The mind, of course, thinks that it is making the decisions. And I always love the, I believe it was William James I first read this in. He talked about the fact that we don't know who is making the decisions or when the decisions get made. When you decide to get up in the morning, you actually don't know when you will get up. You may think, well, I'm going to get up right when the bell rings because I'm going to be a good Zen student and get down to the Zendo. But the bell rings and you may roll over on your side and think, well, I'll be a better Zen student if I get 5 more minutes of sleep. Then I'll be able to get to the Zendo. And you don't know when you'll get up until your feet hit the ground. Whatever your plan was, until it happens, until you embody it, it is just a fantasy. Sometimes your predictions may be right, sometimes quite wrong. But what happens when we loosen the certainty of this self? Loosen the one philosopher talked about the user delusion. Gregory Bateson said the idea of the self is the greatest epistemological error of Western civilization. But of course, not just Western civilization. As we read these ancient teachings, it's clear that men and women, centuries and centuries ago, were dealing with the same things we are. And so this wonderful monk, sincere monk, comes and presents himself. And as we've said, quite a courageous thing to do, to present yourself. And as we sit in our zazen, we are, of course, presenting ourselves to God and country, presenting ourselves to the universe. Here I am. And we allow ourselves to be seen. I had a friend who took a hiking trip in the Alps, quite an enthusiastic hiker and camper, and as she was walking, she was conscious of not just seeing, opening her senses to the incredible peaks and valleys, but also of allowing herself to be seen. Earlier in the retreat, we talked about a donkey sees the well and the well sees the donkey. Can we participate on both sides? So as you are sitting here, as I am sitting here, can I practice allowing myself to be seen? Because usually we are curating our self-image, trying to bring forward the better parts of ourself and manage or hide or do something with those other parts we don't like. But here in the silence and stillness, and as we give each other this wonderful gift of non-interference, we do our best not to look around. We say not to look away, so we are alone together. And as we sit and as we move through the day, we don't have to worry about putting on a face or putting on a self to meet the eyes of others, but we give each other the gift of not peeking, not checking on others. How's she doing? Oh, she's sitting really still and looks very blissed out. I wish I could be like her. Meanwhile, she is going through her hell realm, doing the best she can, or whatever. Of course, we make up stories about each other all the time. But we are committed here to turning that beam of light inward, to being ourselves, and this gift of not checking. As we practice more and more, we can perhaps begin to give ourselves this gift of not checking. Because most of us are quite concerned about our Zen career. How am I doing? Had a good day. How am I doing? Oh yeah, not well. I'm going to fire myself pretty soon here. I just don't seem to have what's needed. Can we be present in the moment, presenting ourselves, being ourself without checking? All these ideas, of course, doing well, doing terribly, are just thoughts arising in the mind. They are utterly unreliable and utterly predictable. So they will come up and they're not a problem at all, only a problem if we believe them. Lin Shi talks about having confidence. And the root of confidence, as I love to say, con fidelis, with fidelity, with authenticity. So having confidence does not mean you are always sure of yourself. But it means when you are unsure, you are clearly unsure. And you can present your doubt and difficulty as yourself in this moment. And no need to hold on to doubt and difficulty as yourself, which is what will happen. Oh, I am the one who is dim and dull. Dawi says, if you cling to the one who is dim and dull, imagining yourself, if you cling to this self-image, that's a problem. Your dimness and dullness is not a problem at all. And this is good news for most of us, right? That whatever is here, we can present, we can embody, we can be fully our miserable self, our inadequate self, our wondrous self, our incomprehensible self, our sweet self, our outrageous self. And so here in the Zendo, it may look like things are quite repressed. But in fact, we say yes to this discipline in order that we can allow a degree of wildness, allow a degree of not knowing that usually is not possible for most of us. This ancient technology of awakening, of being still. Of course, none of us are still, but we slow down and we become more and more still. Whenever our Shuso says maintaining stillness, right? I hope we all think it's about us. Sit even more still. But this stillness of the body and the breath, we come back to stay as simple as we can. The Prajna Paramita, the great supreme wisdom that we sing of in the Heart Sutra, this wisdom is not collecting more and more. This is not a wisdom of knowing, but this is the fundamental wisdom of life. The content of this wisdom, we say, is emptiness, or the content of this wisdom is the absolute, or the content of this wisdom is just things as they are. Beyond thinking about it, beyond opinion. The amaryllis bud knows exactly what to do if we give it time. Giving ourselves the time, cultivating the great paramita of patience. Perfections, 7 or 10 different schema of them, but the first is almost always dana, generosity. Second, sila, or right behavior, ethics. And the third is kshanti, patience. We cultivate sitting upright. And Linchi reminds us that if we are trying to become awakened, and Dawi says too, most of us put the idea of awakening as an obstacle before us and imagine there's somewhere else to go, somewhere, someone else to be. So can we sit upright in the fullness of who we are, which is not who we think we are, but this being that is the life, the essence of us, your true self, we might say. This true self that is the whole universe, this life of the true self, which is everything, the functioning of you and the world together. So just like we can say there is no life without death, we can also say there is no you without the universe. You and the universe together. So this being ourself is an act of allowing, an act of appreciating, both that there is no one else you can be, there is no one else you have ever been, nothing has ever been hidden, nothing has ever been wrong. And we can clarify this and know this for ourselves. We can practice the great risk of breathing out without planning the inhalation, of breathing in without worrying about the exhalation, allowing our life to live us, allowing our breath to breathe us, allowing the walking to walk us. And in this way, we take the backward step and begin participating, closing the gap so that there is this intimacy of life that is not about Buddha, Dharma, or Sangha. It is not about stories of encounters between teachers and students. It is not something like that, but rather the shimmering aliveness of all things, the shimmering aliveness that is the illumination that has no shadow, including life and death, including light and dark, the stillness that includes movement and stillness, this true self. A monk said to Fayan, "My name is Wei Chao. I ask you, what is Buddha?" Fayan said, "You are Wei Chao." Thank you. So I invite you to sit comfortably, and we'll have a Dharma dialogue. Two reminders. One, that we are on being recorded, so if you'd like to say something off the record, we'll pause it briefly. The other thing is that today we have a little microphone that we need to pass around. There's one of us needs extra support in hearing. So when you raise your hand, I'll come and give this to you. And then you can just, I think, just hold it while you talk. Is that good? Yeah. And then just hold on to it, and the next person will raise their hand and you can
take
it.
Needs to come back to us.
Oh, right. Needs to come back to us. Yes.
Yeah, actually, yes. Let's have Esther will be the jisha of
Great. Great.
The pendant, the medallion.
So you'll make your remarks and then we'll sit over.
Melissa. Snap it. I
can't hear you. Okay. So, comments, questions.
So, as someone who often sees himself as being dim and dull, you know, not just here but everywhere, this retreat has been interesting because, you know, in a room full of, especially the Dharma dialogues where we get to talk about our responses, I go, oh, those problems that I have, other people have them too. I'm not the only one, this, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of nice. And then Jenny's question, especially yesterday, said, you know, when do you ring the bell? When the bullshit meter fills up? And I thought, wow, I'm not the only one who feels that. And it's been it's been really comforting and starting to hear in these, in the koans themselves, I'm like, oh, well, Melissa didn't actually hit me that time, but what she said was, had the same intention, you know, and starting to understand, it's like, you know, these people in the room now, the people who are here, you know, next week, next year, or the people 1,000 years ago, we're all the same. And it's just really, yeah, just feeling more of that oneness, and it's been wonderful.
Yeah.
Thank you all.
Can I just say one more thing? If you do not hold the pendant, but hold the rope.
Hold the rope.
Hold
okay.
the rope. Did you hear that? So you have to hold the rope.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Yeah. Yeah.
So thank you, Corwin, for that. As you were talking, I got this really strong sense impression of the Zendo full of lumps of clay. Some of you know that David is a potter. And, you know, that we could... Potters just can't leave the clay alone. That would be one way of being a potter. I guess you just have a big pile of clay. So the piles of clay come into Doksan. And part of the work of the teacher-student relationship is that the student is willing to just sit there and be the clay. And they're also willing to receive, you know, little, we're shaping the clay. So eventually the clay is still clay. Nothing has changed except the shape of it is now a vessel to receive the Dharma, right? And to express the Dharma. And that's a very serious job description, right? So sometimes, and then, you know, I'm going to keep this metaphor going. Because then the clay vehicle needs to go through the fire. It actually, and that happens in the Zendo. That doesn't necessarily happen in the Doksan room. And it gets baked and really becomes a vessel for the Dharma. And then eventually breaks. Right? And there's no clay and there's no vessel and all that. It's just talking. But so it is a really cooperative enterprise of willingness, us daring to tweak and shape. You know, I mean, we could be hitting. That's another way. You could have a tool. But it's more like this, that, this. Yeah, over and over and over again. So thanks for giving me the opportunity to make up a metaphor.
and a couple things. One, I do think the part of the value of these Dharma dialogues is exactly what you say, because it's so easy to feel that whatever I'm feeling or struggling with is what is deficient about me. Right? And if only I didn't feel like the teacher didn't really want to talk to me, or if only I wasn't insecure. And it's such a relief to hear other people suffering. and truly, and so important, because what you are encountering is not just you, which is the amazing thing about this. You know, that we can sit upright and not be conversing with each other very much, but that what we encounter is human life. When we stop taking it quite so personally, then it gets even more interesting. Then it's not my anxiety, but it's anxiety. Or it's not my sorrow, but sorrow. And then I think we can have more courage. You know, this is not what's wrong with me. This is an entry point. This is my vow to meet life. So that, and then I also want to say, there's so many ways to think about Doksan, and one way is the image of an egg. And the chick, as it's about to hatch, actually starts pecking from the inside. And then the parent chick, I guess usually it's the mama, but I'm going to take that on too, can peck from the outside. And if it's only pecking from the outside, it doesn't work, right? It's not ready. You know, that's forcing it. If it's only pecking from the inside, it doesn't work. And so I think you spoke of the mutuality here. And for me, really, I don't know what any of you should do. It's not like you... I know it's disappointing. when you come in the room, I don't have the sense, oh, this is Ray. Well, I know what Ray should do. He should, you know. It's much more a process of discovery together as we come into the moment. And then the real teacher in the Doksan room is the Dharma. And we touch something, and when we touch something real, I don't know what's going on in your mind. But those connections that go, and you might think, wow, David knew just what was going on. No, I have no clue. But there is a faithfulness of the Dharma that if we meet, if you come as yourself, and I come as myself, and I bring my experience, you bring your experience, that we can play these roles of pecking from the different sides and be released in that.
And the other piece too, just to go back to the usefulness of the Dharma dialogue, is, and I think David pointed to this already, but I just want to say it in a slightly different way, that when you hear that other people are suffering like you, there is that commonality of experience we all have as human beings. Sometimes we share in the Doksan room about our own experiences because we've been students too, and we're still students. You never stop being a student. This study goes on forever till the very last out-breath. And I'm curious about this group in particular, just because many of us have been together now for a while. Is there any... Well, I won't say this. I want to ask you to raise your hand. But just checking, how many times do people say things in the Dharma dialogue and we think, oh, yeah, just like what Corwin's expressing, oh, yeah. And I didn't want you all to raise your hands because I know from teaching groups for many, many years that there's often one or two people who hold out and say, I'm not like any of these people. My suffering is my suffering and no one can understand me. And that's like the chick inside the egg who's not yet ready to peck. So everything goes, you know, like nobody's doing anything wrong, right? If you're still holding on to, I'm the only person in the world. There's another koan we keep referring to. I am Ching Shui, solitary and destitute. The implication is I'm the only one like me. And then maybe you can be awake to hearing the me too, you know, when somebody says something like that. So this is, there's a huge egg going on with many, many chicks inside in a Dharma dialogue. Yeah, so thanks.
Thanks. Yeah, Carol.
Thank you for giving all these Dharma talks just for me. I want to come back to some of the metaphors. So I really loved from the Dharma talk the gift of non-interference. You know, I really felt like I've received that gift.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of curious about how it fits with the lump of clay thing too, because you know, you shape the clay, and then my experience is that if I'm clay, I completely misshape myself after meeting with you and go somewhere else. And so how does the non-interference fit with the shaping and the firing and the becoming distorted? You know?
Yeah.
So David interfered with the amaryllis bulb. He put it in a pot. He covered it with soil. He watered it. He still waters it. Sometimes he overwaters it. this is the, yeah, we had an experience. flooding.
Wasn't me.
It wasn't me. No, it was that guy who stole your bath.
I know. I think so. I'm on to him, though.
You know, the mysterious happenings, I just wanted to go after a little. As David says, it's a public place, and we did have a series of robberies a couple of years ago. They took strange things, and we know it wasn't us cutting David's bicycle brakes. That happened. Somebody broke into the garage, and some of the and when we talked to the police, one of the things they stole was a lot of our frozen fruit from the freezer, and the policeman said, "Yes, there's been a rash of robberies, and one of the characteristics is that frozen fruit has been stolen." So, these are mysterious things.
Jenny?
She drives in from the
store. No, I bring it here.
Okay. That's right. That's right. I got that.
Oh, you bring the frozen fruit, right. Anyway, back to this interfering, non-interfering. This is, you know, it's never just like this. It always has this other aspect. And if we just leave stuff alone, you know, that doesn't work either. If we just say, oh, well, you know, the planet's getting warmer, but I'm just going to sit and go to retreats and blah, blah. No. No, we actually have to interfere. And it's a dance between doing and being. You know, there's one graffiti that was very popular when I was at university in the 70s that I think it was Nietzsche said, to do is to be, and Kierkegaard said, to be is to do, and Frank Sinatra said, doobie doobie doobie. It is this...
Boy, that says it all.
So moving. So there's back and forth, right? The back and forth. We must respond to the world, and we also can't take complete responsibility for making things happen. And this goes back to the Doksan, the student-teacher relationship, too. So if the Amaryllis is David's student, he sets up the conditions, he tends to it, and trusts that eventually the thing will flower. And those of us who get to be here till Friday will probably see it, I'm predicting. Right now it's still just a little bud, but it's getting bigger every moment.
I think it's really a wonderful question, I think, for all of us in the world. I mean, not just in the Doksan room. When do we trust the innate creativity and the innate Buddha nature of the people we're with, and when do we intervene? And, you know, as we train Dharma teachers, it's one of the things we're working with, how to recognize this. And for me, it's so important as we do this Doksan, that our job is to perceive the Buddha. Perceive Buddha after Buddha walks into the Doksan room. When I remember that, then just like with the amaryllis bulb, part of my job as a gardener is to appreciate. And I think all of us need to be appreciated because we're so sure that we aren't Buddha. Right? So I think the biggest gift any teacher or any human being can give you is adoration and appreciation as you are, not as you're going to be. And so then from that foundation to see, and when someone sees you in that way, what could be more precious? And then out of that seeing, sometimes, you know, I'll say, you know, cut it out. Stop doing this. Speaking to that Buddha nature that's already present and relying not on, not even relying on my insight, but relying on your Buddha nature. You are Carol. And my job is to see and appreciate and cheer and challenge and say, yes, yes, you are Carol.
Should we?
Yes.
Yeah. So we're going to come back into our posture for meditation.
Thank you.